Chief Judge Bonnie Bulla of the Nevada Court of Appeals, and with me today in Las Vegas is Judge Deborah Westbrook, and in Carson City is Judge Michael Gibbons. While I do not anticipate any problems, because court and counsel will be participating at two separate locations via Zoom, I would ask that everyone be mindful of this when asking questions and responding to them. And I'm reminding myself as well, because I seem to have the most difficulty in the last case. This is the date and time set for the oral argument in case number 86780 in the matter of, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Nyman versus Nyman. At council table in Las Vegas, we have Abraham Smith on behalf of the appellant and Dan Marks on behalf of the respondent. Mr. Marks, would you please identify who's present with you? Okay, thank you. Each party is limited to 15 minutes of argument. Mr. Smith, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal? Very good. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Bulla, and may it please the court, Abe Smith for Natasha Love. I recently read an article critical of our former president, calling him the president who could not choose. In this case, we had the district judge who could not choose. Or rather, the district judge made one critical decision that Siragusa versus Siragusa foreclosed any request to modify family support alimony beyond the original period for which alimony was decreed. And then that one decision reverberated throughout the case. So this jurisdictional abdication resounds in the failure to consider whether Michael was in arrears at the time and refusing to hold an evidentiary hearing on that issue. It also undergirds the district court's failure to interpret the party's reservation of jurisdiction provision and to determine whether its preconditions have been met, say, for example, by non-payment of attorney fees. It also echoes in the refusal to consider the duration or the amount of child support and consider any adjustment thereto. And finally, it echoes in the equitable or so-called equitable consideration of Michael's voluntary payments, an unpleaded claim that not only made an indigent mother who was solely responsible for raising the party's children newly indebted to a multimillionaire who shirked that responsibility, but also stripped Natasha of post-decree interest to which she was entitled. It is true that a district court ordinarily has discretion when setting alimony and child support. But here the district court refused to exercise its discretion largely because of its initial jurisdictional error. As Michael can Judge Westbrook, I welcome your question.
Let's jump into issues. It seems to me that there are sort of two separate jurisdictional issues. One involves exclusively Siragusa and the question of modification. Was their jurisdiction to modify? Under the reservation of jurisdiction clause, that to me seems to be a question of whether there was jurisdiction to enforce the decree, whether it was necessary to enforce the decree to enter an award of compensatory alimony. So we seem to have two separate kind of concepts here. The original motion that she filed was a motion to modify alimony, to change the award in the decree based on changed circumstances and citing the statute. The argument that I hear you making seems to be that because the district court could have looked at the reservation of jurisdiction language in the decree, which allows for jurisdiction as necessary to enforce other provisions of the decree, the court could have awarded compensatory alimony. So two separate kind of concepts. I'm wondering, to decide if the district court had jurisdiction under Siragusa, it had to answer two questions. First, what was the original term under the decree, and was Mr. Nyman in arrears on alimony at the expiration of that term? Would you agree with that under Siragusa and under the modification standard?
I do agree with that. And I think that the reservation of jurisdiction provision is also consistent with that.
Okay. And to answer the first question, what the original alimony term is, doesn't the plain language of the decree itself control what that term was, as opposed to what the parties were actually doing?
Well, no, because the parties had the ability to modify their decree, right? I mean, and the district court wasn't interested in this, so there was no
Okay, but did you ever present testimony or evidence? Paragraph 14 of the decree says the terms of the decree may not be amended, modified, or altered except through a written agreement signed by both parties or an appropriate order of the court. Did you ever present, or did your client ever present, a written agreement signed by both parties indicating that the term of alimony had been changed from what was in the decree?
So two answers. One, yes, and then even if the answer were no, that wouldn't help Michael with the arrearage. So first, yes, at pages 330 and 331 of the second volume of the record on appeal, we've presented the text messages that discuss delaying the start of the quote unquote 7K in light of Michael's agreement to pay full tuition. Now that 7K consists of the $3,000.
So you contend that was a written agreement signed by both parties to modify the term of alimony?
I mean, I understand that, you know, in this digital age, that, you know, it's not a wet signature, but we have other ways of authenticating a party's assent to something. And in this case, the response to the text message would be essentially an authenticated response equivalent to a signature from Mr. Naaman. But again, we also have the behavior consistent with that modification.
Well, Mr. Smith, aren't stipulated divorce agreements governed by the law of contracts?
Yes, I agree. I mean, I think that's what...
So we're looking at the stipulated divorce agreement on its four corners, essentially, to determine what should go forward in this case, or what should be happening here.
Well, so let me move to my second point, and then I will go back to your question, because I don't want to lose sight of the fact that Michael has presented no evidence that he made any payment before July 1st.
Okay, so I will stop you there, because okay. in your client's briefing below, in the record on appeal at 222 in the motion, there's a statement: Michael already made his spousal support and family support payment for the month, which we believe to be the final month those payments are due. So there was a representation to the district court in the initial motion that there was no arrearages on the family support aspect. Then in the record on appeal at 306, the reply brief: regardless of the start date listed in the decree, alimony was not paid in full until all 84 months of payments were made, which didn't occur until June 2022. So these representations were made to the district court that all payments had been made by June of 2022. Why was the district court supposed to conduct an evidentiary hearing to determine if he was in arrears on those payments in July?
So again, our contention was that the parties had agreed. This was actually giving grace to Michael, right? That they'd agreed to modify the start date of those payments to begin in July as opposed to in May, right? With that 2-month extension, the last payment period would have been June of 2022, making her motion timely. When the district court said, no, I'm reading Sir Gusa to say that you have to look at the original period. If that had been the case and the alimony had been due starting in May, yet he didn't make any payments until beginning in July of 2015, then he still would have needed to make that payment. The payments in April of 2022 would not have satisfied, he would have been in arrears as of April 2022. In fact, even in June, he would have owed post-decree interest for those 2 months that he was late on paying his alimony.
But why couldn't the court rely on the representations by your client in the moving papers as to what was paid and what was outstanding?
We think we can rely on that. And under what we represented that was that June 2022 would have been the last month for which payment was due pursuant to the party's modification.
And they were due on the 1st and the 20th, correct?
I think it's the 10th and the 20th. But
10th and the,
yeah.
Okay, 10th and the 20th. So after the 20th, that's would be the last date, correct?
No. That's so now we have to go to Shriver, right? That's the case along with Siragusa that says even if somebody prepays alimony or pays at the beginning of the month, the alimony period lasts through the entirety of that month.
I don't believe it said month. I said the period of the. I think it says the period of the agreement. Period of the alimony term that's in the decree,
right.
Correct?
And this
decree, you know, has specific dates.
So exactly, but in our case, for example, when she gets a payment on, let's say, June 1st, or let's say take the first payment, July 1st, 2015. That payment is to support her through the month of July. The support period is that entire month. That's exactly what it says in Shriver and Siragusa. And if the alimony, so if the party timely pays alimony at the beginning of the month, nonetheless, a motion filed at the end of the month would be timely, notwithstanding the fact that the last alimony payment had been made, because it's for support through the entirety of that month.
I want to make sure that we're talking about the right terms here, because there's alimony and there's family support. When you're talking about the arrears, are you talking about the family support? Because the alimony is rehabilitative alimony, right?
So I am talking about the family support alimony, okay. Correct.
Okay. And that's where your position is that the respondent had arrears, and therefore modification of the alimony award could be undertaken?
Either that there were arrears or that the parties had modified their agreement so that June 2022 was the last month for which alimony was due, which again under Shriver would have made her motion timely. But under either scenario, right, under the reservation of jurisdiction provision, the arrearage on attorney's fees constitutes, in this integrated support order, a form of arrearage that would support jurisdiction.
Okay. And I want to ask a little bit about that, delve in a little deeper, because the reservation of jurisdiction provision, as I read it, appears to permit an award of compensatory alimony when the court deems that compensatory alimony necessary to enforce the decree. And as you mentioned, it's an integrated decree. So if one thing, you know, is not met in one spot, it could conceivably impact the rest of it. So I get that argument. What I want to know is why it was necessary. Why would it have been necessary to award compensatory alimony in this case, as opposed to simply entering a judgment for the amount of arrears that was found? Because we're talking about, I think, what, you know, your client was representing below was about $30,000. Why was compensatory alimony as a remedy necessary for the purposes of making her whole? Why couldn't the court have, I mean, couldn't the court have just as easily said, as it did here, $6,500, he still owes $6,500, I'm going to order, reduce that to judgment, that must be paid. Why is compensatory alimony necessary?
Well, it gets to the whole purpose of the family support alimony and the great disparity between the parties' incomes. As the divorce decree itself had noted that the alimony was set with respect to the parties' present incomes. So the fact that those incomes vastly diverged over time presented a circumstance where, yes, there did need to be an adjustment to account for that.
That seems to get to the issue under the statutory factors for modifying alimony. There was a change of circumstances such that alimony could be modified. But the reservation of jurisdiction provision is specifically dealing with enforcing the prior decree.
And maybe we're talking past each other a little bit, so I want to make sure I understand your question. It sounds like you're drawing a distinction between compensatory alimony as defined in the preservation of jurisdiction provision and family support alimony, such that there couldn't be an overlap. But I think the whole purpose of the preservation of jurisdiction provision is to expand the opportunity for the district court to not just, in fact, under Azeltine, right, even modifying the decree where the decree allows for it is a form of enforcing the decree. And the parties never said, well, we're going to, you know, waive our rights under NRS 125-150 in favor of this alternative route for compensatory alimony.
Well, I don't think she actually even raised compensatory alimony or the reservation of jurisdiction provision at all until her reply brief. Her motion was exclusively a motion to modify under the statute, was it not?
It was a motion to modify. Now, I mean, if we're going to pick nits about whether something appeared in the initial motion or the reply brief, I would have much more problem with them recovering, $15,000 on an unpleaded claim for unjust enrichment.
Mr. Smith, I just don't mean to interrupt you, but you have like less than
10
minutes.
I know.
So I just want you to address rehabilitative alimony briefly, are you suggesting the offset was inappropriate and why?
Yes, the offset was inappropriate for actually some of the same reasons that we've been discussing with respect to the preservation of jurisdiction provision. And that's that the district court found that that Michael was or should have been aware that Natasha was no longer attending school. That was the precondition for her to continue to receive rehabilitative alimony. Instead, they had a conversation, as she testified to, and Michael was aware that, yes, she has these other needs. She's caring for his child from another relationship. Her children have very extensive handicaps that Moore's revealed in the sealed portion. And he, nonetheless, took it upon himself to continue to make payments. Now, he's perhaps characterizing them now as overpayment of rehabilitative alimony, but the fact are those were voluntary payments. The district court never found that there was an expectation that those were pursuant to some legal obligation that he had, and there was no discussion that he was legally obligated to pay those pursuant to the rehabilitative alimony portion of the decree. So I don't think that unjust enrichment was the right bag to reach for in that situation. It was, at the very least, a gift, or if not, a voluntary payment. I'll reserve the next few seconds for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Marks.
Chief Judge Bola, members of the court. Every day in Clark County, hundreds of people are in court. There's a whole courtroom on Flamingo of people who don't pay their child support, don't pay their alimony. Michael Naiman is one person who for 7 years made every single payment that he was supposed to pay. He overpaid $30,000 so he could see his children, and he was hauled into court by his ex-wife in what honestly was just a money grab. She hired Marshall Willick. This is not Mr. Millionaire beating up poverty. She hired Marshall Willick, who is considered one of the top 10 family law attorneys, and paid him tens of thousands of dollars, arguing or trying to change the law that somehow there could be alimony after all the payments were made and the term had totally run. And in their original motion, which was all of 5 pages and 4 pages asking for attorney's fees, they admitted it. And what else should the judge have done? Under Zaragoza, if you make all your payments and the term has run, it's over. And it should be over, because you have said in other cases, Davidson, and there's a statute, divorce doesn't go forever. You don't need a CPA at your hip pocket. These rules post-divorce are supposed to be made so people can go on with life without an attorney. Michael wanted to go on with life. He was very successful. You were allowed to be successful. But there was no evidence in her original motion, beginning Zaragoza, there was no evidence in her original motion that would have allowed an alimony modification if she had filed it a year sooner. Because in the motion calendar, it's not notice pleading. There must be law, there must be facts, and you're supposed to attach declarations and or exhibits. So if you are 5 years into alimony and you want to allege hypothetically that because of COVID, your school, let's say, was closed and you needed additional time to take a course to get your degree, that is legitimate, but you have to send a letter to opposing party or counsel, do a meet and confer. If you can't work it out, you must file the motion with your backup, meaning your receipts, your declarations, your medical evidence. And then the judge can weigh the paperwork and make a decision without an evidentiary hearing, or, and you've urged in a lot of cases, the benefit of the doubt goes to an evidentiary hearing. In this case, there was, counsel is implying there was no evidentiary hearing. This was unbelievable, the procedure here.
I want to ask a quick question, if you don't mind me interrupting. So one of Mr. Smith's arguments on the decree is that allegedly these text messages would have constituted a signed writing or writing signed by the parties that such that would modify the terms of the divorce decree and extend the term. How do you respond to that
argument? To protect pillow talk, NRS 123 says when you're married, contracts must be in writing and notarized. the decree itself to protect text messaging or some other, you know, alleged change, a decree is a court order, paragraph 14, must be signed by the parties and presumably signed by the judge. And something as major as an alimony modification has to be signed. These messages are meaningless because the law is the law. The courts have said, you said this in the family court system, for instance, I think in Fernandez Rivera, do whatever deals you want. But if you come to court, we're going to follow the law. She should have quit while she's ahead. She was $30,000 ahead. Why she would hire an attorney and allegedly pay $40,000 to bring him to court on a five-page motion that says nothing, doesn't meet the minimal standards, why not keep the 30? When you read her motion, there's no basis for modification, and there's no amount, and there's no duration, all of which would be in any rudimentary motion. Regarding their allegation of paragraph 16, they want to read it as de novo alimony, that after 7 years, under paragraph 16, you can come back and because one party did well, you can just say, let's like redo the trial. That's not the law. That paragraph is a classic Siragusa. If you recall, Dr. Siragusa bankrupted his property settlement back in the 90s when you could do that. You can't do that anymore because the bankruptcy law changes. So people have for 30 years put these provisions in. They're really not needed now. But it only applies if, for enforcement, as I think your question pointed out, they're not a de novo, oh, you're ripped, so we're going to award more alimony. If he didn't pay some property settlement provision or some provision, you could, under that provision, which is in accordance with Siragusa, enforce the decree. It's not a blanket, let's revisit alimony. There's no law.
It doesn't support modifying alimony as opposed to an award that would be compensatory to enforce the decree.
Right. It says specifically it's utilized to enforce the decree, and those provisions have been known since the 90s when Siragusa was decided by the Nevada Supreme Court. In terms of Ms. Indigent, this is what really happened. Mr. Willow conducted discovery for, I think, 6 months. There was no there. No one wants to lose and then lose again. He filed a motion to withdraw. That should have been a wake-up call. There was nothing here. She went ahead on her own. Her depo was set, she didn't show. There was a pretrial memo due. She didn't file it. Her exhibits were on the table, the 16,200 pages of discovery that she dumped in a box on Judge Hoskins. No judge has to take your 16.2 discovery and try to piece together what's admissible.
Mr. Marks, I think one area that we didn't get a lot of questions in with Mr. Smith was the issue of the $15,000 that the court ordered his client to reimburse to your client. Did the court ever make any findings to address the argument she made below that that payment was a gift?
Let me get to that. But I want...
That's actually, I think, an important issue for
okay.
us to...
And I have time. I want to just have you understand, no one beat up on this person. She had significant due process. The judge kept saying, for me to help you, you need to tell me what you want, why you want it, and where's the backup. So the schedule of arrears that is given at the self-help center is the same one I would use. It can be filled out with anyone with an elementary school education. All it asks is, remember, it's family court. So the client knows if they didn't get a child support payment, this is the date, this is the amount, child support. If it's alimony, this is the date, this is the amount. He has allegations of unreimbursed extracurricular activities. You have to have a schedule. This is the dance class. This is the date. I asked my ex for it. He refused. And here's the receipt. It's not that hard. It's all within the purview of a party. She did none of that. She didn't supply anything. Now, Mr. Woolick specifically asked when he lost the motion to modify, to not grant 54B certification, which I don't think would have been valid. The court wasn't going to do it anyway. So there was 8 or 9 months of discovery and a full-blown evidentiary hearing. If they had uncovered anything that would have helped their cause, they could have brought it. Because as you know, in a non-jury trial, essentially the record's always open until the finds of fact conclusions law. And then the judge, after giving her every chance in the world, essentially saying to her, please, what is your claim? What is your backup? She couldn't produce anything.
Well, she didn't have an attorney at that point, did she?
She didn't, but arguably she could have gotten one. But if you think he owes you money for something within your knowledge, meaning dance class, or this is what they were fighting over, and one notation says she only thought he owed $627. Okay.
I want to turn to the rehabilitative element issue.
He kept paying the rehabilitative, and normally in family court, you always tell clients you can't stop without a court order. She was obligated to notify him that she had dropped out of school. That was her burden. I wasn't the attorney below. I was brought into the appeal, and neither was Mr. Smith. But it's very common where, when a client's advised, I can't stop paying, I have to file a motion, I have to get back into the legal system, and there's a threat of them not seeing their kids, they just keep paying. He just kept paying. If he had stopped paying, they would have used that as a reason to modify and extend.
Okay, but did the court actually make any findings? She argued below that it was a gift.
Yeah.
Did the court, in anywhere in the court's order, did the court address her contention or make findings based on the respective testimonies, weighing the testimony and saying, you know what, I find that this was not a gift. He felt compelled to make these payments. Was that finding in there?
I don't think he dealt with the word gift because it's ludicrous. I mean, I think people say on appeal it's a gift. I don't think there was ever a legitimate argument it was a gift.
Mr. Marks, let me interrupt you here. Why wouldn't we apply the voluntary payment doctrine in this situation where he continued to pay? And I understand the circumstances that you've demonstrated to us in terms of, you know, not wanting to be in contempt either of an order. But why wouldn't we apply the voluntary payment doctrine here? And I guess my second question would be, can you point to any place in the record where he first knew that she was not attending class?
Here's the issue. How is she hurt? They're focusing on, she owes him, I think, $8,000. She's to the good $15,000. Arguably, the judge could have recouped everything back to us. The judge split the baby.
Right, but her financial situation is much different than your client's, and I'm just trying to understand why the offset or the reimbursement for $15,000 was appropriate in a circumstance where he is paying when she's already breached, right? She's already breached the agreement for the rehabilitative alimony because she's not attending class and she didn't apparently notify him of that. So she's already in breach.
So this is what the judge found. She had the obligation to do it in the decree. Because she didn't do it, he was rightful to keep paying. Because the judge found he knew or should have known she wasn't in school, he kicked her back $15,000. It's just a classic split the baby down the middle.
Right, but isn't that an acknowledgement that he knew that he was making payments that he didn't need to make?
That's what the judge found.
Wouldn't the voluntary payment doctrine apply?
But it's over. We're talking about my client has a judgment for $8,000, even though he was the prevailing. He got no attorney's fees. They found nobody was a prevailing party, even though she lost every issue and she could have sat and not filed the motion and been $30,000 to the good. She's $15,000 the good. My client's not executing it. It's been 2 years. My client's taken no steps to execute. The kids are 18 or over. They're in college and gone. If the issue is there shouldn't be a judgment against her, I'm sure my client would agree to not pursue it. He has no interest in being in this legal system.
But aren't you asking for attorney fees on appeal as the prevailing party under the decree itself?
We are. They were asking for all sorts of, they claim they're prevailing party below, which they're clearly not, to protect our clients' rights. We're saying, should we prevail here, we have the right to, you know, to come back and ask for fees. Would he ever come back to the district court and ask for fees? I can't answer that standing here.
But aren't you asking us to be the ones to?
We're saying that we should be the, I think clearly we should be the prevailing party, because if somebody has $30,000 in the bank and they go to court and come out with $15,000, they certainly are not the prevailing party. And the issues they've raised clearly violate Siragusa, and they had competent counsel from the very beginning, esteemed counsel, and they wouldn't stop. They forced Michael to go through a full-blown evidentiary hearing literally for no reason. So now we don't want to get into a fight over fees and have a secondary fight that will never end. We want finality. We would ask the court to affirm. My client, I'm sure, would waive pursuing execution and pursuing her because he wanted finality. He felt after 7 years and $600,000 or $700,000 in payments, the end, there should have been an end. The kids are 18. They're trying to raise this issue obliquely about kids being handicapped. They're scholarship students, 3.8 GPA in high school. The other son is in Michigan on scholarship. There's nothing here for this court to do, we say, other than to please just affirm and end this.
Mr. Marks, just briefly, the children are all 18, so has the child support payments ceased? They're over.
He made his last payment. He's the kind of guy that called me, hey, graduation is this date. What should I pay? He doesn't want to be involved in the family court system. He wanted to just comply and be done, and he's been hauled in now for the last 3 years.
I just want to make sure, Judge Gibbons, do you have any questions you want to follow up with? I know it's difficult being in Carson, looking at everything on video, but I'm probably going to give Mr. Smith a couple of additional minutes since he has like 29 seconds, which probably is not going to be very effective. So if you have any additional questions for Mr. Marks, Judge Gibbons, feel free to ask them.
Well, both counsel have done a great job, and I'm applying the old maxim that you can learn more by listening than talking, so I will sit back.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Smith, how about I give you like a minute and a half addition to the 19 seconds?
Thank you very much, Chief Judge Bullock. So on the last point first, this issue of the kids' GPAs being 3.8, them having scholarship, the district court never conducted the analysis under NRS 125B110 to decide whether the kids were actually handicapped or were able to support themselves. That inquiry would need to proceed on remand. And there's a case law in the CFR that talks about attending school or college, even in Edgington, of course, saying that attending college, being in the top of your class, is not evidence in itself of a child's ability to support himself. Second, the district court's finding on page 831 of the volume four of the Record on Appeal, given the discussion between the parties at the time, Michael knew or should have known that Natasha was not attending school. He then goes on to say that Natasha had an obligation, an affirmative duty, to provide proof of attendance. But if you look at the decree, Natasha was not in violation of that provision of the decree. It says that she has an affirmative duty to provide proof of enrollment. That would only exist when she's enrolled. There's not a corresponding obligation to notify him when she has not, when she has disenrolled. In fact, it says in the event Natasha is no longer enrolled at the Institute of Higher Education, Michael shall not have a continuing obligation to provide this rehabilitative alimony. That proceeded precisely according to how the decree was written. And in fact, she did go above and beyond because she did notify him. She testified and the district court found that he knew or should have known. So there was a discussion. Those payments were entirely voluntary. And he asked, how is she hurt? She's hurt because he's using that supposed overpayment, which is really a voluntary payment, to strip her of jurisdiction. And the last point in my last 13 seconds, if there was no modification to the start date of the alimony, his payment was due May 1st. He did not make a payment on May 1st. If he paid through June 30th, through June 2022, he would have still had arrearages for accrued post-decree interest. Thank you.
Thank you so much.